All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to be jumping headfirst into a pretty pivotal property law case in Rhea State of Michael. We're talking Pennsylvania Supreme Court back in 1966. This whole thing really hinges on how crucial, crystal clear legal language is, especially when you're trying to figure out who actually owns what. I mean, you're all law students, so you know this stuff already, but getting into the nitty-gritty of a classic case like this, well, that's where those light bulb moments happen.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't matter if you're cramming for property exams or already daydreaming about your legal career. This case is like the perfect example of how those basic property law concepts actually play out in real life. And that's what we're going to do. Break it down step by step and highlight all the important legal ideas and big takeaways.
Exactly. And let's be honest, we're here to make your lives a little easier. Think of this as your cheat sheet to In Rhea State of Michael. We're going to pull out all the most important points from this case brief. The facts, the legal reasoning, the court's decision, the whole nine yards.
Yep, that's the plan. We're your guides through this legal maze, ready to shine a light on what really matters.
All right, so let's get this show on the road. We're talking about a piece of property called King Farm. The story starts with a deed way back in 1947 created by Joyce E. King. She transfers this property to not one but two married couples. So you have Harry and Bertha Michael and then their son, Ford, with his wife, Helen. Two generations, all getting a piece of the pie.
And here's where things get interesting and messy. The way the grantor describes how these couples are going to own the property, that's where the legal headaches start. The deed says, get this, Harry L. Michael and Bertha M. Michael, his wife, tenants by the entireties, and Ford W. Michael and Helen M. Michael, his wife, as tenants by the entireties with right of survivorship. That last little bit. With right of survivorship, that's the spark that lit this whole legal fire.
Oh yeah, that right of survivorship is key. So let's fast forward a bit. Harry kicks the bucket first, then Bertha. When Bertha dies, she has a will. In her will, she leaves King Farm to her son, Robert. But she also gives $1,000 to Ford, her other son. You can see where this is going, right?
Oh, absolutely. The big question becomes, did Bertha even have the right to give away her part of the farm in her will? Did she actually own it in a way that let her do that? It all comes down to what kind of ownership was set up back in 47.
So to get why the court made the call they did, we got to rewind a bit and look at the legal scene back then. Tell me about this Act of 1812. Sounds like a big piece of the puzzle.
Oh, it's huge. The Act of 1812 basically flipped the script on how Pennsylvania law looked at owning property together. See, before that, joint tenancies were all the rage, thanks to English common law, but Pennsylvania decided, we're doing things differently. They wanted clearer lines of inheritance, less property changing hands without a will. So they made this presumption against joint tenancies, meaning if you wanted that right of survivorship, where a dead owner's share automatically goes to the other owners, the deed had to scream that intention. Otherwise, they'd assume you meant something else.
So it's like they leveled the playing field for other ways to own property together. Okay, let's clear this up. We've heard the terms joint tenancy, tenancy in common, even tenancy by the entireties. What's the difference, especially when we're talking about this survivorship thing?
All right, so joint tenancy first. Imagine each owner holds an equal, undivided piece of the property. But the kicker is, if one owner dies, their share automatically goes to the surviving owner, no matter what their will says. No probate court for that chunk.
So it's automatic. It's like a legal bypass for inheritance.
Exactly. Now, tenancy in common is a different beast. You still have owners with shares, but they don't got to be equal. And the big difference, no automatic survivorship. If an owner dies, their part goes into their estate, gets passed on through a will or state law if they don't have one. It's classic inheritance.
So it's the typical way we think of inheriting stuff.
Yep. Then there's tenancy by the entireties. This one's special only for married couples. It's like joint tenancy with that right of survivorship, but just between the spouses. Neither one can sell their share without the other's okay. And usually, creditors of one spouse can't touch the property. It's all about protecting the couple's ownership.
So with tenancy by the entireties, what happens when one spouse dies? Like when Harry died, did Bertha automatically become the sole owner of their part of the farm?
That's right. That half of the farm was theirs as tenants by the entireties. Harry dies, boom, Bertha's the sole owner of that half. The question the court had to grapple with was, how did that tenancy by the entireties fit in with the overall ownership with Ford and Helen? Were they all joint tenants together with that right of survivorship spanning both couples, or was it something else?
All right, let's dive into the court's decision then. They said the language in that 1947 deed was ambiguous. What wording tripped them up?
Okay, so the majority opinion zeroed in on that phrase, with right of survivorship. It was tacked on at the end after it already said each couple was taking their share as tenants by the entireties. See, the court said that because tenancy by the entireties already has a right of survivorship built in between spouses, adding that phrase at the end muddied the waters.
I see. So they were wondering if that phrase was just stating the obvious because of the tenancy by the entireties already.
Exactly. That was one way to read it. But the other side argued that with right of survivorship was meant to create a whole new level of survivorship between the two couples. So when Harry dies, eventually his and Bertha's share would go to Ford and Helen after Bertha dies, and the other way around.
But the court wasn't buying that second interpretation. What convinced them?
Well, a few things. First, they noticed the deed didn't use the specific legal term joint tenants. Now, it's not always a deal breaker, but using the right legal lingo. It's like legal drafting 101. Not having it here made the argument for a joint tenancy between the couples weaker.
Yeah, makes sense. If you want a specific legal outcome, using the right legal term seems like the smartest way to go, right?
Right.
No room for confusion.
And this next part is super important. The court really leaned on what's called the habendum clause. That's the part of a deed that lays out the type of ownership you're getting. In this deed, the habendum clause said Harry and Bertha and Ford and Helen would have and hold the property, their heirs and assigns forever.
Okay, their heirs and assigns forever? Why is that so important?
Because the court said using heirs legally, that means folks entitled to inherit property, either through a will or state law, implies that each couple could actually pass down their share. That's a hallmark of a tenancy in common, where you can leave your part to whoever you want. In a joint tenancy between the couples, there's no inheritance like that. The surviving owners just absorb the share. So heirs pointed away from a joint tenancy.
So heirs means you can inherit, which wouldn't happen in a joint tenancy between the couples.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the Act of 1812 with its whole bias against joint tenancies right on top of all this.
Bingo. The court decided the deed didn't clearly express that the grantor wanted a joint tenancy with survivorship between the couples. The right of survivorship phrase was vague, plus there was that heirs and assigns clause. So the Act of 1812 kicked in. The law defaulted to interpreting it as a tenancy in common between the couples.
So it's not one big happy ownership with both families inheriting everything. It's like two halves, each couple owning their part as tenants by the entireties.
Exactly. Which means when Harry died, Bertha got full ownership of her half of King Farm. And because she owned it outright, she could do whatever she wanted with it, including leaving it to Robert in her will.
Not all the judges agreed with this, though.
Right.
What was the dissent's take?
Okay, so the dissenting justices thought that with right of survivorship was clear enough, even if it wasn't perfectly placed. They thought it showed the grantor wanted a joint tenancy between both couples. They said the majority was being way too picky about the wording, like they needed to see the exact words, joint tenants between all grantees. They thought the overall intention was obvious, even without that specific language.
So the dissent believed that right of survivorship should have applied to all four grantees, not just each couple separately.
Yep, that's the heart of it. They thought Joyce Kim, the grantor, wanted the property to go to the last surviving person in either family. They said the majority focused too much on the missing legal terms and not enough on the big picture, the overall intention.
Okay, so what happened in the end? Who got King Farm?
The Supreme Court overturned the lower court's ruling. They said that 1947 deed created a tenancy in common between the two couples. That meant Harry and Bertha and Ford and Helen each owned an undivided half of King Farm. And within each half, they owned it as tenants by the entireties.
And what did that mean for the families?
Well, the big thing was that Bertha became the sole owner of her half of the farm when Harry died. She owned it free and clear, so her will was valid. Robert, her son, inherited that half. Ford, the other son, still got his $1,000 from the will.
Wow, that's crazy. Few little words in a decades-old deed decided who got a whole farm. It's like a giant legal domino effect. Talk about why being precise when you're writing legal stuff matters.
No kidding. This case is a major lesson for lawyers.
Hmm.
When you're trying to set up a joint tenancy with survivorship between people who aren't married, you got to be super clear. Like, use language that leaves zero doubt. As joint tenants with right of survivorship between all grantees and not as tenants in common, something like that. It might sound repetitive, but it'll prevent legal battles later.
So for those of you listening, In Re Estate of Michael is a prime example of how little mistakes in legal documents, especially property stuff, can have huge consequences. It's not just about being a good lawyer. It's about protecting your clients and avoiding those legal nightmares down the road.
And for all you law students, this case shows how important it is to understand property law basics and how courts interpret documents. You've got statutory presumptions, specific legal terms, and the court's mission to figure out what the grantor wanted. It's like a real-life legal puzzle.
And think about this. It's not just about the words on that old deed. What about the bigger picture? What values or policies influence how courts handle ambiguous property transfers? Are there hidden principles at play, like the idea that land should be easy to transfer or what people normally expect about inheritance? These are things worth thinking about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into In Re Se Don Michael.